This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Listen closely. That's not just paint rolling on a wall. It's artistry. A master painter carefully applying Benjamin Moore Regal Select Eggshell with deftly executed strokes. The roller, lightly cradled in his hands, applying just the right amount of paint. It's like hearing poetry in motion. Benjamin Moore, see the love.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of New Books Network. This is your host, Morteza Hajizadeh from Critical Theory Channel. Today, I'm honored to be speaking with Dr. Matthew Clayman about a fascinating book he published with New York University Press called Symbols of Freedom, Slavery and Resistance Before the Civil War. Dr. Matthew Clayman is professor of history at the University of Houston and the author of The Battle of Negro Ford, The Rise and Fall of a Fugitive Slave Community. Matthew, welcome to New Books Network.
Thank you for having me, Maury. It's a real honor to be here.
Thank you. Before we start talking about the book, could you please briefly introduce yourself to our listeners? Tell us about your field of expertise, how you became interested in history, and particularly the history of slavery and resistance, and the idea of the book, how the book came about.
Okay, sure. Yeah, I'm a professor of history at the University of Houston, Houston, Texas. For as long as I can remember, I've been interested in U.S. history. I grew up in Baltimore, which has an incredible history with Fort McHenry and the Civil War, but also Frederick Douglass and Harriet Tubman. So living there as a young kid, it's hard to escape that history. So I've always been fascinated with slavery. As I got older, slave resistance became a real passion of mine. As I was in graduate school, entered graduate school, I thought that historians still had not given slaves and enslaved people their due regarding they're both passive and active resistance to slavery, especially violent slave resistance, revolutionary slave resistance. I still think it's an undertold story in the part of American and Atlantic history. So this book came about when I was in graduate school. I encountered what we would call a fugitive slave rebellion in Rockville, Maryland in 1845, and it occurred over the 4th of July weekend. And while there is no documentation of the motives of the escape, although we know that these 75 roughly slaves who had escaped were trying to get to the North in freedom, they were armed and they ended up fighting. Several died, most were captured and resold into slavery or returned to their owners. But abolitionists who learned of this escape attempt, they made a big deal about it in the abolitionist press, and some writers, at least one in particular, referred to these escaped slaves as the disciples of the Declaration, because the abolitionists assumed that these enslaved people knew about the 4th of July, they knew about the Declaration, and thus this must have inspired them. And that certainly got the ball rolling in my mind about what impact did the Declaration, did the 4th of July have on enslaved people and their allies. And the more I did research over the years, it was not just the 4th of July or the Declaration, it was the U.S. Capitol building. It was the language, the war cry of Patrick Henry, give me liberty or give me death. And I have found that over the years, enslaved people took great inspiration from all these symbols of freedom, and the same with their anti-slavery allies. So that's sort of the origin of the book.
And the book actually, there were a lot of the interesting facts and surprising facts for me in the book. So broadly speaking, you talk about different symbols of freedom, such as 4th of July or American flag, and how it's been maybe appropriated or used by both the proponents and opponents of slavery. Well, let's broadly talk about the American flag, and then also I'll ask you later on about the 4th of July. How did the proponents of slavery appropriate these icons?
Yeah, you know, so the book covers an extended antebellum period, so from the aftermath of the War of 1812 through the outbreak of the Civil War. So we're talking almost a half a century. And anyone who studies this period knows that following the Battle of New Orleans, the American victory, if you will, over the British in the War of 1812, we enter an era of good feelings. It was an era of supernationalism. It's an era where, you know, national holidays are established, Washington's birthday among them. The American flag is standardized by Congress for the first time. It, you know, it's been 30 years and America did not have a standardized flag. So you see at this time, Americans are coming into their own. They are really embracing this national identity. They have finally actually, you know, freed themselves from British tyranny. It's taken a long time. And at the same time, slavery is expanding. The internal slave trade or domestic slave trade is expanding. And what's really rather disturbing is how slave owners and slave supporters, slave owners' supporters, slave owners' allies, Southern white politicians, Southern white officials, they begin this disturbing practice of, you know, hanging American flags outside of slave pens or slave prisons. Coffles of enslaved people are marched across the South with, you know, one of the slaves being forced to carry an American flag as they walk. Slave coffles are being marched in front of the U.S. Capitol. And so all the while, it's like these pro-slavery advocates are actively promoting not only slavery, but they're trying to make this declaration, if you will, that slavery is a national phenomenon, that it's synonymous with the Stars and Stripes. And what my book shows is how not just enslaved people, but their allies, they push back against this and they fight to reclaim those symbols as legitimate symbols of freedom, not slavery.
And the 4th of July was also a very interesting case in your book as well.
Yeah, I find the 4th of July just, you know, it's still just an amazing, you know, holiday. It sort of, people gather and celebrate, but you could definitely argue that, you know, that the holiday has kind of lost its way, and today just see the 4th of July as a opportunity to drink alcohol, yeah, overeat, fireworks, and a lot of people are injured in these, you know, firework explosions. And what you see in the early 19th century is the 4th is initially synonymous with the Declaration of Independence, right? The 4th of July is a celebration of national independence, which is really marked by, you know, symbolically by the Declaration of 1776 on the 4th of July. And Northerners and Southerners, initially, they see the 4th similarly. It's a day to commemorate and celebrate American independence. But increasingly, you find that white Southerners start to sort of twist and turn and shape the 4th of July into less of a freedom celebration and more of just what it is today, this bacchanalia, this celebration of food and drink. And especially on Southern plantations, enslaved people were given an abundance and overabundance of food on the 4th of July. Oftentimes they were given drink on occasion. There were foot races that were held. There were raffles that were held and lotteries. And it was just sort of a day, you know, it's a great day off of work. It was a distraction, but it becomes depoliticized is the bottom line. Mm. And at the same time, Northerners are increasingly arguing that the Declaration of Independence should be America's founding document, you know, even more than the Constitution, because of the idea, quote unquote, that all men are created equal. The 4th of July for a lot of Northerners becomes a reinvigorated celebration of the ideology of freedom and equality. And for white Southerners, you see the opposite happen. And the 4th of July, like I said, becomes very depoliticized, and it becomes a day of just, you know, not working, a day of food and drink, but has very little to do with the Declaration of Independence, certainly not the idea that all men are created equal.
And in your book, you talk about many different characters. There was this person, James Dickey, and this story that happened in 1822 when he saw a group of slaves carrying an American flag. Can you talk about that story, please?
Yeah, this is a real touchstone movement of American abolitionism. And, you know, Britain had a great abolition movement, but you just don't see anything like this because it's across the Atlantic. most British slaves are enslaved in, you know, the West Indies. It's very different in the United States, where slavery is everywhere originally, and then it is exclusively a Southern institution, but it is always in the nation's capital, right? It'll be in Washington, D.C. through the Civil War, and that just becomes very pivotal. But, you know, regarding the flag, you know, James Dickey is a Southern abolitionist who moves north because he feels like an outcast in the South in the 18 teens. And he's a preacher. And one day he's just, you know, minding his business in rural Kentucky, and he hears this marching band basically processing through the woods. And he assumes it's some sort of, you know, grand celebration of you know, maybe the 4th of, it wasn't the 4th of July, but he can't quite figure out what is going on. But it sounds like a militia band or a marshal band. And lo and behold, his curiosity gets the best of him. He goes to see and hear what's happening. And he sees a huge coffle of slaves, maybe 50 slaves being marched through the woods. And there's a band playing, and then slaves are forced to play instruments as they march. And at the front of the coffle, as you know, I mentioned earlier, there's a slave carrying this massive American flag. And Dickey is just absolutely enraged by this. He's insulted, he's embarrassed as an American. And what he does is he has abolitionist connections. He's an abolitionist writer, and he writes an account, very brief account of what he sees. And it very quickly starts to circulate in abolitionist media and print culture. And, you know, a decade later, artists, abolitionists and anti-slavery artists, they begin to depict what he had seen and described in a series of wood engravings that will soon, you know, be publicized all over the North. They'll be part of the great postal campaign of the 1830s, where abolitionists mail more than a million pieces of literature, anti-slavery literature, to Southerners and to Northerners as well, but across the country. And this is one of the defining images of slavery and abolition in the antebellum era, this idea of a slave coffle being marched through the woods.
And another story I really liked was 12 years or so, the memoir by Solomon Northup, right?
If I'm
pronouncing the name correctly, which I guess they made a movie out of that as well, 12 Years a Slave. Can you talk about that one, that part of the book as well?
Yeah, and you know, so many accounts of all these flags being displayed in front of slave pens and the events on the 4th of July, they're second or third hand oftentimes, but Solomon Northup gives a firsthand description of what it's like to be enslaved in a pen in the nation's capital in the 1830s, 1840s. And he writes about this in his narrative after he, you know, eventually serves 13, he's a slave for 13 years, eventually escapes. But in one of the, his many powerful moments in his book, but one that I find very moving, is where he talks about how he, when he realizes what has happened, he was drugged, he wakes up, he's beaten mercilessly. And he comes to the realization that he is going to be enslaved for maybe the rest of his life. And it's just, it's a moment we can't even begin to imagine the horror. And he looks outside the windows of this slave pen in Washington, D.C., and he sees the U.S. Capitol. He sees these American flags of liberty waving high above the so-called Temple of Freedom. And he very, you know, poignantly writes that what kind of nation is this? You know, the hypocrisy couldn't be any more profound. And so Northrop, he has this penchant for just really, you know, getting at your gut. And for abolitionists, you can imagine they read his account. And this is a first person account of just the disgrace that was being made of these symbols of freedom. And it really does motivate them to sort of fight, to not only get rid of slavery, obviously, but also to reclaim America's meaning. Is this going to be a nation of freedom as it was intended, or is it going to be something much worse, a nation of slavery?
You earlier, before this question, you talked about that famous famous picture that was based on James Dickey's what James Dickey witnessed. But what other sorts of iconography or imagery was used in anti-slavery publications?
Yeah, a lot of it. So definitely the American flag. You see oftentimes the U.S. Capitol, you see in a lot of abolitionist imagery, the heading of the William Lloyd Garrison's Liberator, it almost always had an image of the U.S. Capitol in the background and the headmast. And in front of it was usually an enslaved person being whipped or a slave auction, depending on what year of the Liberator. So abolitionists were very fond of using those. I think another icon that some people might be surprised about, I find just absolutely fascinating, is the American Eagle. And today we generally just think of the American eagle as a symbol of freedom, the way it flies, it's a massive bird. But British abolitionists actually were the first to point out that that an eagle, just in general, is a predatory a bird. And so the British were fond of sort of saying that the British lion represented freedom once the British got rid of slavery in its territories in the 1830s. And they pointed to the American eagle as this predatory bird that, you know, its prey was African Americans. And this was something that American abolitionists eventually embraced and visualized, again, in some of their illustrations. So oftentimes in anti-slavery pamphlets, the Anti-Slavery Almanac is a great example of this, they will have this visualization, this image, this illustration of an American eagle attacking an enslaved person. Oftentimes it's a Black woman, sometimes with her child. The talons of the eagle are ripping to tear the woman, you know, into pieces. And so for abolitionists, this is their way of saying, you know, we want this bird, this American symbol, to represent freedom. And it is currently, as the British have pointed out, represented something, you know, something wholly terrible and something awful.
One of the most interesting parts of the book to me was that sort of contradiction between what American values represented and also how anti-slavery proponents try to use to base their arguments, let's say, on American values. But how did it work? How did they try to sort of maybe get around those contradictions? For example, American symbols of universal freedom and exceptionalism, it didn't really apply to slaves, but they did try to use those arguments. They did try to use icons of American nationalism to sort of, you know, inspire resistance towards slavery. Can you talk about this part, please?
Yeah, and Maury, I got to tell you, I think it's easy to say, and it certainly makes sense to say that these symbols, just like freedom, was never intended to apply to slaves, right? It was never intended to apply to African-descended people. And looking back after, you know, hundreds of years of racism and white, but I got to tell you, when you dive into the primary sources, you just find these enslaved people and these abolitionists that, despite some of the obvious things that the founding fathers said and did, the fact that, you know, half of them who ratified the Constitution were slave owners themselves, these people, they did not accept that sort of premise, that these ideas of equality and freedom did not look back. And because of the rise of white supremacy, the triumph of racism in early American history and much later, that this is the way it was supposed to be. This is the way it was always intended. But words have meaning. And I think it's just fascinating to find how these enslaved people and their allies, they were so stubborn in refusing to accept the idea that those freedoms were limited or that America's ideology was selective. The way they interpreted it, which is the way I choose to interpret it, and the way a lot of people interpret it today, is that idea of freedom and equality, it was supposed to apply to everyone from day one. And, you know, so again, certainly many of the founding fathers didn't intend it that way, but that's not the way the message was received by large portions of the American population. So if there's anything that really just fascinates me about this whole subject is how, you know, governmental leaders, you know, people who create a nation, people who, you know, write constitutions and declarations of independence, they may have one intention or meaning in their mind, but the way it's interpreted can be something very different. And that's, you know, it's sort of the point of the book, how today we're still fighting over symbols. These symbols still matter. And certainly enslaved people and their allies in the early 19th century, they saw the founding ideals and documents and interpreted it in one way. And a lot of white Americans went in a totally different direction.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
Hey, welcome to IKEA, where even this desk is circular.
Huh. How so? Looks pretty rectangular to me.
It's because we're always looking to repair, reuse, and relove our products, like buying back your IKEA items for store credit. Or shop our as-is section for great deals. You can even order free spare parts. Get on the circular path for a more sustainable future.
still a rectangle.
Get started at ikea-usa.com/circular. Visit ikea-usa.com/circular for as-is information and buyback and resale terms and conditions. Spare parts not available for all products.
And I think one great example is Frederick Douglass. His speech, "What to the Slave is the 4th of July," and he emphasizes American values there in support of American values in support of anti-slavery. What question I have, maybe this is even not really, this phenomenon still happens, but when some people stand for truth, stand for justice, they are called traitors.
Right.
I'm kind of curious to, because you in the book, you talk about this famous speech. It would be great if you could talk about that and also maybe tell us if at any point Frederick Douglass was also considered a traitor by other abolitionists because he was supporting the Constitution. It was using those values to dismantle slavery.
Yeah, great questions. So Douglass, I actually consider the speech, which many people have long determined it's his greatest speech, I consider it sort of his personal declaration of independence. You know, he's an escaped slave. He gets to Boston. William Lloyd Garrison, sort of a titan of American abolitionism, becomes his mentor. And for years, as you can imagine, Douglass has this sort of complex that he doesn't belong, that maybe he doesn't fit in, that he's not as good and talented as all these other intellectuals who went to Ivy League schools and have been, you know, preaching, and they've been lawyers for all these years. And so the first decade or so, Douglass just follows along and sort of intellectually just, you know, follows their lead. And Garrison and all the Garrisonians, they were very strong on certain issues. And one of them was that the Constitution was a fiercely pro-slavery document. And as a result, or as such, they denounced the Constitution and they did not believe in America's political process. They thought that American politics, the American government, was permanently and fundamentally flawed. Garrisonians, they actually, by the mid-century, they support disunion, and they would ask for the North to separate from the South because of the firm beliefs on a lot of these issues. But Douglass gets around to the point that, like, maybe we should still participate in the political process despite America's flaws. He thinks that we should form a political party or two. We should all vote on Election Day. And he also decides that maybe the Constitution has been misread by, you know, Garrison and all these other leading abolitionists. And so now it's interesting, when I teach the Constitution, it's clearly a pro-slavery document. It has all these pro-slavery measures, three-fifths compromise, the closing the Atlantic slave trade, fugitive slave clause, things of that nature. But everyone has to admit that the Constitution does not, the founding fathers intentionally did not put in that document the word slave. They did not permanently legalize slavery. They did not in any way concretize or make concrete slavery's permanence. So they left a little window, is what I'm saying. And Douglass understood this. And he thought, wow, now why did the founders do this? Well, clearly, even if many of them own slaves, they are not only hopeful for the end of slavery, they're leaving the tools to get rid of slavery down the road. So the bottom line is 1850 to 1851, Douglass changes his mind and he decides to give this great speech on the 4th of July. And he is going to lay out his, you know, the justification for why he now is going to interpret the Constitution a different way as an anti-slavery text. And also why he's going to ask abolitionists to join, you know, in fighting against slavery by using the political process. And so to answer your, you know, your other question about treason, the answer is yes. I mean, abolitionists, his best friends, literally, almost all of his mentors, actually, they reject him at this point. And they, you know, denounce him, they criticize him, and it's very nasty in some of the press. And it could have been worse, but they're very harsh towards him. And he moves to upstate New York almost to escape much of the criticism. For the next couple of years, he's not invited to abolitionist events. And when he does attend, he is literally ignored. He's kind of a pariah in many circles of abolitionism. So by the mid-1850s, Douglass is intellectually his own man. And he is adamant. And he definitely still has some close allies. And they are arguing that the political process is a legitimate process of change and reform. We must do that. But he's also arguing, he's banging the drum for that the Constitution is an anti-slavery text. And so it really just shows, you know, number one, the abolitionists weren't always united for obvious reasons. But here is this man, and it's taken so long, but man, he is ready now to take his leadership to a whole different level. And he actually does that. And by the time of the Civil War, many of those Garrisonians have lost a lot of clout, a lot of power in the movement. And Douglas is as influential as any abolitionist in history at that point.
And speaking of people maybe who are his opponents, can you tell us who David Walker and Henry Highland Garnet were and how they approached to anti-slavery differed from that of Frederick Douglass?
Yeah, they are African-Americans. David Walker was born free in the South. He ends up in Boston, Massachusetts, and starts to, you know, agitate for anti-slavery. He becomes an abolitionist writer in local newspapers. Henry Highland Garnet, his family escapes from slavery in Maryland, not far from where Douglass was from. But Garnet was just a child when this happens. So he's pretty much raised in the North, and he's a free Black Northerner for all intents and purposes. But by the 1840s, and Walker dies early on, but by the 1840s, these two men have written documents. David Walker had published what was called his appeal. Henry Highland Garnet had given this incredible speech in 1843, 1844. It was called like a speech to the slaves. And both of these Black Americans, for all intents and purposes, they call for slave revolution. These are Black radicals. And we all know that the African Americans sort of led the American abolition movement. And African American abolitionists were typically more radical than their white, you know, brethren. For different reasons. A lot of them still had family that were enslaved. Many of them had been enslaved. And so for them, this was a zero-sum game. Like slavery had to go. It had to go now. There was no moderation that could be tolerated. And so, you know, Douglass comes from the South, and he's an adult he's in his upper teens when he escapes from slavery. And he very quickly becomes sort of a very pivotal abolitionist figure. He's sort of the face, as I've said, of the abolition movement by the 1840s. And he is always a little hesitant to call for violence. He's always a little hesitant to call for slave revolt. He's hesitant to advocate for slave revolution. And so there's tension even among African-American abolitionists. But make no mistake about it, by the 1850s, after the Fugitive Slave Act is passed in September of 1850, as abolitionism increasingly becomes violent, and as abolitionists increasingly help slaves escape through violent means, Frederick Douglass starts to join David Walker and Garnet in promoting radical ideas of violent abolitionism. So there's a lot of sort of ideas percolating in the movement. And, you know, Douglass embraces some, he disregards others, but certainly the idea of militant or violent abolitionism, which had been in the ether since, you know, David Walker's pamphlet came out in 1829, Henry Highland Garnet's speech in the 1840s. But by the 1850s, you know, Douglass, he takes it now full throttle, and he is going to argue and advocate to get rid of slavery by any means.
And so the book is about these symbols that have been appropriated maybe by both opponents and proponents of slavery. But what sorts of icons of American identity were used in unifying this divided nation?
Yeah, I would say the American Eagle, as I mentioned before, the abolitionists are really trying to promote it as an actual symbol of freedom, not some predatory pro-slavery bird. You know, Frederick Douglass, I mentioned in the book that when he escapes from slavery, he dresses as an African-American sailor, and he borrows a uniform of a Black sailor that he knows, and he also borrows the free papers of a Black sailor that he knows. And on one of these free papers is an image of an American Eagle, sort of rubber stamped on the document. And when he's on a train heading to the North, and when a conductor asks to see his free papers, he shows him this document. He points at the Eagle and he says, "With this Eagle, I can go anywhere, basically on the planet that I want to go. Like, you can't touch me, I'm a free man." Also very famously, when the Civil War starts, and he becomes one of the great advocates for Black soldiers. And he gives this famous quotation where he says, you know, "Let the Black man get an eagle on his button." And I think he says a musket on his hand, in his hands, or a musket on his shoulder. And he says, you know, they will become Americans. They will die for this country. So for Douglass, this eagle means something. And so for abolitionists, this eagle means a lot of things. So you see a lot in the imagery of the American abolition movement, the appropriation of the American Eagle, to sort of take it back from the pro-slavery forces. So this really does become a unifying force, definitely regarding the visual images of the time.
Maybe a final question is about, I've talked to several people about the history of slavery, and I always ask them this question, what they think when some people mention that, with all goodwill, they say that, well, slavery is abolished now, let's move on, history is history, let's forget it. Maybe, I'm not sure, so I'm happy to be corrected, maybe they say that in the spirit of sort of unknowingly denying the fact that still racism still exists. So my question is, how do you respond to these comments, and how is this book relevant to us? What lessons does it have for us today?
Great question. You know, and I agree with you, and there's, you know, I think we're so divisive and we're so angry, and, you know, there are people who say we're in a post-racial era. There's people who say, you know, racism is done or it's minimal, and we can react in two ways. We can get very upset and just as angry and say, you know, you're wrong, you're ignorant, you're racist. And I don't find that to be productive. I don't find it to be helpful. And honestly, when I talk to people and I hear it from students, and when I read things online, I still read newspapers, it's a lot of people who say these things, it comes from a good place. Like, they're hopeful. They want to live in the United States where slavery is forgotten and the pain of slavery and Jim Crow and all that stuff is gone, but clearly we're not there. So my take on it is, it's time to sort of, okay, we need to just acknowledge that racism is still prevalent. We also need to appreciate that it was, you know, far worse than most people give it credit, that slavery was far more of a destructive institution than most people acknowledge. And it wasn't just the physical abuse of African descended people, it was the psychological abuse, it was the generational trauma. And it persists long after. But once we acknowledge that, I just think there's one way we get out of this is we could use these symbols of freedom, just like the abolitionists tried to do, as sort of something to rally around and to sort of, you know, re-emphasize and underscore that the United States is supposed to be different. It's supposed to be better. And, you know, Frederick Douglass in his speech, believe it or not, he was a former slave, for goodness sakes, and he's a great advocate, a zealous advocate of the idea of American exceptionalism. And a lot of people, you know, are very critical of American exceptionalism today for obvious reasons, me among them, quite frankly. But Douglass is steadfast in his belief that the United States has, and he's writing and talking in the 1850s, that just the unequaled potential as a nation, a land of freedom, equality, and opportunity. And, you know, other scholars have used the term aspirational American exceptionalism. And that's what Douglass is talking about. He's not saying America has accomplished American exceptionalism. He's not saying America is not without faults. He's saying America is flawed. And the number one flaw, he argued, was slavery, and connected to that was the racism. So I think today we can still rally around the idea that America has all of this incredible potential. And we should sort of look at the American flag as a symbol of freedom, the American eagle, the national anthem, all these great, you know, sites around the country that people go to and visit. But we can still acknowledge we haven't reached the hilltop yet, not in any way, shape, or form. So we still have a ways to go, but it doesn't mean the dream of American exceptionalism should die so easily. And I also think, like, the book, and one thing that just motivated me as I wrote this, was there's this tendency today, and it reminds me of sort of just Christianity in American history. And, you know, a lot of everyone is familiar with the term the Christian right today, and how Christianity in the United States has really been appropriated by the far right. And it has been very much used in recent years, if not decades, to very far right conservative purposes. But people are less familiar with the idea of a Christian left. And when I hear that expression, I think of Martin Luther King. And I think of Union soldiers during the Civil War who were, with their Bibles in their hands, were going to the battlefield willing to die to free slaves. And so, you know, Christianity, Islam, you know, these religions can be used in certain different ways. And I think national symbols are the same way. The flag, the emblem, the eagle, it can be appropriated by far right, it can be appropriated by far left, it can be appropriated by people in the middle. So these are highly contested symbols, and they can be used for good and they can be used for ill.
Thank you very much, Matt. But before we end this conversation, I'm curious to know if there is any other book or project you're currently working on.
Yeah, there is. And it kind of is an outgrowth of this book. So I've just, for years now, I've just been buried in the archives with all these examples of violent slave resistance. And we haven't even talked about like Patrick Henry and his, who I didn't mention earlier, but the idea of, you know, to be an American citizen, you're supposed to adopt this principle of give me liberty or give me death, right? And we see it around the world today, oppressed people fighting, dying. They just want to be free. And freedom ain't free. And so sometimes you have to pay the ultimate price. And so many enslaved people, as they escaped from slavery, as they fought slave catchers, as they lifted up weapons in rebellion, they literally cried out, give me liberty or give me death. I mean, it's a fascinating thing. But as I said, oftentimes they're carrying weapons. And so where I'm headed now, my next research project is the role that guns and knives and other lethal weapons they played, not only in the antebellum South and just American history, but also slave resistance. And so I'm not, you know, very familiar with guns. I've never owned a gun, but it's a fascinating topic. The idea of American gun culture, and a lot of people think that this is a new phenomenon, but I will make it very clear that Americans have been familiar and comfortable with guns for a long time, and so also have been slaves at various times in various places. So it's a real fascinating study that's sort of just getting underway, but I think it's going to be pretty cool and interesting stuff when it's all finished.
Thank you very, very much for your time to talk about this wonderful book, New Books Network. I personally learned a lot from the book. And like I said, I guess throughout the interview, there were a lot of interesting facts that completely surprised me when I was reading the book. So I strongly encourage our listeners to read the book. Thank you very much, Matthew.
Thank you so much for having me. I love the conversation. Greatly appreciated.